Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we hear the unusual story of Albert Cashier, a Civil War soldier from Illinois with a surprising secret. We also hear about a horn symposium that was held recently in Macomb, revisit our interview about the world's largest ketchup bottle, and hear about one woman's efforts to go green by dumpster diving. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The International Horn Symposium is the biggest event of the year in the horn world. In years past, it's been held in places like Beijing, Cape Town, and Valencia. This year, it took place in Macomb. Rich Edgar tells us about it.
One thing becomes immediately clear while walking through the Western Illinois University Union during the week-long event. Horn players are not shy about picking up an instrument and giving it a toot. One of the people checking out new Yamaha horns is David Amrim. He's a world-renowned artist who's experimented with the horn in different musical genres.
And one of the first things I did, I could show you on this wonderful Yamaha horn, was to take the traditional French horn sound. And using the jazz idea.
Amrim says he was encouraged to experiment by musicians such as jazz legends Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker.
Also, the great conductor Dimitri Mitropoulos. He used to say to me, when he was conducting the New York Philharmonic, he would say, "How is your friend Dizzy Gillespie? In his last recording, I admired his new harmonic procedures." He was listening to Dizzy Gillespie as an important composer who composed mostly on the spot when he improvised.
Horn dealers also show up for the symposium. This is Scott Bacon.
It's the biggest event every year for horn manufacturers, for horn shops, for horn players. It's the biggest collection of artists and exhibitors every year.
It's the Woodstock for horn players?
I guess you could call it Woodstock. There are a few parties.
Bacon is with Siegfried's Call in Beacon, New York. It sells imported, handmade horns like this one. One person who makes these horns by hand is Dietmar Dirk of Germany.
When I make a bell, so I see with my eyes how it grows, how it works, and I can feel with my fingers how the material, it's hard or it's soft, or is it like I want it? And when the machine makes it, nobody knows what they make. You know what I mean? It's easier to, for me, it's easier to make it with my hands, and I can see what I make.
Around 600 people attended the International Horn Symposium. They came from places as far-flung as Australia, Korea, and Sweden, Canada, Japan, and Norway. Randall Faust says the event ended up in Macomb this year because he submitted a bid to host it. Faust is a hornist and music professor at Western Illinois University. He knew Western could handle such a big event because it puts on many festivals and camps every year.
Even though, you know, you enumerated we're not the biggest place and maybe the fanciest place in that regard, we have the services available.
The symposium included many, many performances. There were also seminars and clinics to teach techniques on the six different kinds of horns. Most look similar to what was generally known as the French horn. The exception is the Alp horn. It looks like the horn in ads for Ricola cough drops. It's 12 feet 3 inches from the mouthpiece to the bell. Lee Kessinger of East Moline says the length poses a unique challenge for musicians.
It seems so different because on the horn, when you're playing the regular double horn, you know, your sound is right by your right hip, but this is 12 feet away.
This is what Kessinger's Elp horn sounds like next to her mouthpiece. This is what it sounds like at the other end, at the bell, 12 feet, 3 inches away. The theme for the 41st Annual International Horn Symposium was A Place to Study, A Place to Play. David Amram says it's important to play music because it's important to be creative.
Because that's the whole thing, that music is a gateway for that and for people to feel good about what they do and appreciate and respect one another. This music teaches you all of that.
And for 1 week in Macomb, horn players from around the world did exactly that. Rich Egger reporting.
This is Sidetrack. For some, it's just a simple condiment used on hamburgers and french fries. But for one small town, it's an obsession. Collinsville, Illinois is the home of the world's largest ketchup bottle. It was just announced this week the landmark will be getting a makeover in time for its 60th birthday. Back in 2002, I talked with Mike Gassman, the self-proclaimed Big Tomato. He's the president of the World's Largest Ketchup Bottle Fan Club. I first asked him to talk about the history of the town's big ketchup bottle.
This ketchup bottle is a water tower that was built in 1949, and it's shaped like a ketchup bottle, and it is 170 feet tall. Now, that's a 70-foot bottle on top of 100-foot tall legs. It was built in 1949, and the reason it was built was we had a ketchup processing plant here in Collinsville, and it needed a water tower because it put too much of a strain on the city's water supply. So the president of the company at the time, Gerhard Supiger, had the idea of building this water tower, and as part of a marketing and advertising type of thing, they decided to build the water tower in the shape of one of their ketchup bottles. Now, Brooks Ketchup was always known for its distinctively shaped bottle. It was very tapered, and it had a unique shape to it, and that's what they built the water tower like. So in 1949, it was constructed and served the factory well. In the 1960s, the processing plant moved out of town and left the water tower behind, thankfully, and it fell into disrepair. And in 1993, it was in the process of being sold, the land and the plant and the factory, and was going to be sold, and there was talk of having it torn down. Well, there was the Ketchup Bottle Preservation Group was formed, and the group raised $100,000 over the course of 2 years to save the ketchup bottle and have it restored to its original appearance in, that would have been 1995. And since then, we've had a big birthday party celebration for it every summer.
Talk a little bit about the restoration project, what it took to bring this bottle back to its former glory.
Well, it wasn't easy, and in fact, it was a person by the name of Judy DeMoise, who had just moved to town. And as what happens so often, people sort of took the ketchup bottle for granted, and it was just there, and it wasn't really any big deal. And it took somebody new to come into town to realize what a real unique treasure it was for everybody in the community. And Judy had a background in historic preservation and architecture, and she immediately fell in love with this ketchup bottle. So it was her project, and She got underway with some friends from the Council Historical Society, and they formed a group, a 14-member group that undertook this campaign, and they sold T-shirts and sweatshirts and mounted a big publicity campaign to do a fundraiser. And we laugh about it a lot because it was like, you know, one shirt at a time, $5 here, $10 there. There were maybe two sizable donations of maybe $500. And it took 2 years before enough money was raised. The first guesstimate for the cost of the restoration was $28,000. And when the bids came in, the lowest bid was $78,000. Everyone was pretty shocked by that, but they just worked harder and set up a roadside stand at the base of the water tower. And for over the course of 52 weeks, they sold merchandise down at the ketchup bottle and averaged about $1,000 a week, and that's how most of the money was raised.
It seems really ironic that this much effort was put into the preservation of a object for a company that wasn't even in town anymore.
It is kind of ironic, and as the years have gone by, we look back and we realize that the Brooks Ketchup Company was eventually bought and sold, you know, two or three times, and eventually was owned by a large conglomerate up in New York. And at the time of their company restructuring was when they were going to sell this piece of property. And in all honesty, they really wanted nothing to do with the ketchup bottle anymore. And I think that they were moving ahead, and they just wanted to leave it behind and didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so it meant a lot to the people here still. And so it was a grassroots effort from the ground up, and the people took care of business. Now, I have to give credit where credit is due. The Brooks Corporation did pledge $10,000 to it. So I give credit where credit is due, and they were good on their word for that $10,000, and that really helped a lot.
You said that this ketchup bottle means a lot to the people of town. What does it mean? I mean, why is there this attraction to the giant ketchup bottle?
The world's largest ketchup bottle means a lot to the people in town. It holds a lot of dear memories. Most of the old-timers in town either worked at the factory, or they had a family member that worked at the factory, and everyone knew somebody that worked at the factory. And so it's sort of that hometown Americana roots kind of thing that makes everybody feel good about themselves and their community. And it makes our town special. It's a little bit different than any other town in the country or in the world, for that matter. And one thing that everyone talks about, and unfortunately I'm a little too young to remember this, but when they used to brew the ketchup, manufacture the ketchup there was this sweet, ketchupy, tomatoey smell that used to waft through the town, and all the old-timers talk about it, and they miss it dearly. And so with the water tower still there, it still gives them some sort of satisfaction, or some sort of, you know, happiness and pride that it really means something to them.
Okay, now down to the nuts and bolts. If the ketchup bottle was a real ketchup bottle, how much ketchup would it hold?
That ketchup bottle would hold, it has the capacity to hold 100,000 gallons of water, or ketchup, if you look at it that way. And you can do the math and figure that out, that it's, oh, somewhere in the vicinity of 30,000 bottles of ketchup or something like that.
You could work out something where you could have ketchup piped into each home there in Collinsville.
Right, and you know what? I used to have I used to tell people from out of town, or if I'd bring guests into town or whatever, I used to tell them that because we were residents here in Collinsville, they actually had a spigot there at the base of the ketchup bottle where we got our ketchup for free, and all we had to do was take our empty bottles down there and fill them up on our own, and we got our ketchup for free.
And how many people fell for that?
Well, not too many.
So clear this one up for me. What is the difference between ketchup, which is how you guys spell it, C-A-T-S-U-P, and the other term, ketchup, K-E-T-C-H-U-P?
That's a very good question, and we have tried to come up with a very good answer for that and just have not found one. If you trace the roots of ketchup, and if you go way back to ancient times, back in ancient China, they had a sauce, a condiment that they used, and a lot of culinary experts will trace ketchup back to ancient China. It was spelled with a C. The translation is spelled with a C. Through the ages, it just had different spellings here and there, and we're not really sure if it was just a regional thing that has different ways of spelling it or what. Now, we've also heard that sometimes that the ketchup with a C is a little more gourmet, if you will. It's a little more richer or flavorful, but that might just be, you know, some people trying to tout their product a little better than the others. So I wish I had an answer for you, but I really don't.
That was Mike Gassman, the president of the world's largest ketchup bottle fan club, talking about Collinsville's famous roadside attraction. We originally talked back in 2002. This year, the 11th annual World's Largest Ketchup Bottle Festival birthday party and car show bash will be held on Sunday, July 12th. More information can be found at www.ketchupbottle.com. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. This summer in movie theaters, Sacha Baron Cohen stars as his newest character, Bruno. On TV, Stephen Colbert satirizes Pundits Nightly on The Colbert Report. These two are just some in a list of performers who owe a debt to Andy Kaufman, who, in the 70s and 80s, blended comedy and performance art. Kaufman was known for making up strange, annoying personas and staying in character even beyond the walls of the TV studio. His routines frequently bewildered his audiences. Independent producer Eric Malinsky has more.
Andy Kaufman never told a joke. Or at least he never told a joke very well. But Kaufman created a series of innovations that altered the nature of comedy. And he influenced a generation of performers, including Robert Smigel.
In your life, you remember like three or four moments where you laughed so hard you just couldn't control yourself. He's got one of them from me.
Smigel is the head writer for Conan O'Brien, and you might know his alter ego, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog.
And now, here's Andy Kaufman!
When Smigel was a teenager, he used to love watching Andy Kaufman on TV.
Right now, I would like to do some imitations for you.
This was Kaufman's favorite character, a bumbling comedian with a foreign accent.
You know, he was doing his inept Archie Bunker and his impressions, and then he got to this point where he cried, and then the shocking move was at the end when he turned the crying into this rhythmic song. You know, his, I am trying to do for you, but you...
I am trying to do my best. You really showed me what I meant tonight. I am trying to work with you.
I'm just, you know, had to leave the room. I just did not stop laughing. And I was just his comedy slave after that.
Kaufman thought there was nothing funnier than a performer bombing on stage, and most of his routines were variations on that theme. It's no wonder that performance artists, like Laurie Anderson, appreciated him before a lot of comics did. She first saw him live in concert, doing the same crying routine.
I went up to him afterwards and I said, this is so great. I just think you're fantastic. Yeah, I got kind of a wide-eyed stare. Do you think so, really? I was feeling really sad. You know, I was like, uh-oh. Fiction and reality are beginning to blur again in my life, as they often do.
Actually, Andy was famous for blurring lines. He thought the audience could be funnier than the performer if the audience was manipulated properly. He and Laurie Anderson used to perform comedy experiments at the amusement park in Coney Island.
So we're being strapped in for this centrifugal force ride. And after the guys finished checking everyone's belts and safety check, you know, Andy goes, I don't feel safe on this ride. You know, and he starts screaming and then crying about how he wants to get out of the ride and how dangerous it is. And he knows what's going to happen. We're all going to die. And so, of course, then the attendant, everyone's like really pissed off. And now thinking, maybe I shouldn't be on this ride. You know, maybe he's got a point. And so half of the people actually get off because he's done that.
Kaufman's career changed the moment he appeared on the sitcom Taxi. The writers turned his foreign man character into a lovable, quirky mechanic named Lotka.
Thank you very much.
Kaufman regretted taking the role, and he hated the expectations that came with a show business career. So he came up with a new alter ego, a macho, arrogant Hollywood celebrity.
I'm from Hollywood. I have the brains. That's how I win my matches. Is that how you talk, man?
It was a very Borat-like piece of performance.
Robert Smigel couldn't believe how easily Kaufman fooled people.
He was basically doing a character called Andy Kaufman. He just turned himself into a caricature of himself and represented himself a certain way for people who weren't familiar enough with him to know he wasn't really the ass he was portraying himself to be.
Throughout the 80s and 90s, Kaufman was considered something of a freak show in the history of comedy. He was admired, but rarely imitated. Now the comedy world is filled with larger-than-life characters that blur the line between fiction and reality. Take Stephen Colbert. Every night on Comedy Central, he pretends to be a right-wing talk show host called Stephen Colbert.
Which is why I am giving a tip of my hat to Rush Limbaugh for changing the Constitution.
Of course, now everyone is in on the gag, but back in 2006, someone in the Bush administration didn't get it. Just a few months after his show debuted, Stephen Colbert was invited to address the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Stephen ran all the jokes by me at one point because I thought, wow, Stephen, you've got this great opportunity. You're the only person who can insult Bush to his face because you're doing a character. And you can do it couched in compliments and get away with it. But I was wrong. He wasn't able to get away with it.
But that's what made Colbert's performance truly Kaufman-esque. He bombed in the room, but he killed on YouTube. Like with a lot of Andy Kaufman's routines, the funniest part of Colbert's act was not really Colbert himself, but the blank stares of the audience, which in this case included President Bush.
The greatest thing about this man, he believes the same thing Wednesday that he believed on Monday, no matter what happened Tuesday.
But the award for the most Kaufman-esque career should go to Sacha Baron Cohen.
What's up? I'm Bruno.
I'm Ted Milan Fashion Week.
Cohen has adopted all of Kaufman's innovations, right down to the foreign character playing candid camera.
Now our next guest is a single parent. Please welcome Bruno. So what's the baby's name?
I gave him like a traditional African name. OJ.
Well, here's where the similarities end. Now, Sacha Baron Cohen normally promotes his movies in character. But when Borat got bad publicity, he came out as himself and defended the movie. Now, Andy Kaufman would never do something like that. He was a purist about staying in character, to the point where his friends started to worry about his mental health. He faked having a mental breakdown on two different shows. Network executives were terrified of putting him on the air.
But it reminds me of blacklisting, and it's worse than blacklisting because they're trying to stop me from appearing on television.
Why?
Why? I don't know. But I think I have the right to appear on television.
Well, you're on now. You can't be on every minute of your life, Andy.
In short, Andy Kaufman destroyed his career in show business because he thought it would be funny.
But the whole point is, that's what he was making fun of, that scale of success and failure. He was saying, let's have a look at that scale, please. Is that really working for you? So he said, I'm going to be a failure. I'll show you how that works. Because Andy really knew what this place was about. Fame, death, and fear. And money. I really miss him because I think, if anything, that is much more extreme. And I don't think that comedians like Borat is addressing that. I mean, he's kind of been a goofy guy and, you know, getting people to so-called say what they really mean. But I miss the inquisitiveness that Andy had and the tenderness that Andy had for people.
It's a world of laughter, a world of tears, a world of hope and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all. There is just one moon and one golden sun. The smile meets friendship with everyone.
That feature from independent producer Eric Malinsky. It originally aired on Studio 360. Still to come, the secret life of Albert Cashier and adventures in dumpster diving. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. When she was 19, independent producer Carla Seidel went to teach English on the Galapagos Islands of Ecuador. She met, danced with, and fell in love with a surfer named Freddy. Little did she know, she was falling in love with a cannibal.
My first boyfriend was a cannibal, or told me he had been. We were sitting in a discotheque on the Galapagos Islands of Ecuador, where I had been sent to teach English for the summer. The music was loud and pulsing through my body, music of a type I never knew existed, but to which my body said, yes, here is some earth I can crumble and sift through my hands, scrunch between my toes, dig into and move with, offbeat with the flashing lights that move in fleeting waves across my eyes. An island in the Pacific, a surfer boyfriend, no one I know. This taste of another life makes me feel free and refreshed. Freddy sits pressed against me, his arm around my shoulders. He leans into my ear and says in his stuttering speech that at first turned me off, quiero decirte algo. I want to tell you something. Sure, I respond. In the jungle, where I come from, I was a cannibal. My eyebrows shoot up and my eyes bulge so that Freddy quickly continues, but don't worry, I'm not going to eat you. I come back. Did I tell you I'm a vegetarian? A Harvard student and an ex-cannibal may sound like an unlikely pair, but on the dance floor, our steps matched. Freddy and I dance crazily together, crazy in a wonderful, coordinated way. Our turns are fast and sharp, and there's no end to the different motions we create. When we salsa and merengue, Freddy does lead, but for some reason this doesn't bother me. I feel the energy behind his choices of movements and approve of them. I want to follow them because he's a great dancer, and they're what I want to do, too. One day, over a bottle of Inca Cola, my cola, he jokes, because he says he's a descendant of the Incas. Freddy tells me more about his past.
Mi nombre original es Shiwani. Y eso quiere decir pájaro verde.
I was born on the mainland of Ecuador, he says, in the jungle region called the Oriente. My father was king of our tribe, and I was chosen to be the next king. The night before I was supposed to get married, though, I ran away. Freddy tells me that he came to the Galapagos about 6 years ago, not speaking any Spanish. He's not properly documented by the Ecuadorian government, because the government doesn't keep birth records of remote jungle tribes. My parents, he says? I don't know what they're doing now. People don't go to work in an office in the jungle, after all. There is no work, just survival. After that summer with Freddie, I eventually returned to my studies at Harvard, a place that, for all its prestige in my part of the world, Freddie had never even heard of. But Freddie's story and the visceral memory of our dancing together were pulling me back to Ecuador. In 2005, 4 years after first meeting Freddie, I decided to return to the Galapagos Islands to pursue an interest in documentaries and find out if Freddie's story, our connection, and his seemingly carefree lifestyle were for real. Back on San Cristobal Island, there are plenty of new buildings, but it seems that Freddie hasn't changed at all. I learn an expression that locals use for the lifestyle on the Galapagos Islands. One doesn't earn, one enjoys. This seems to sum up Freddie's life pretty well. He surfs, dances, drinks, gets lots of foreign girls, and only works when he runs out of money. His expenses are minimal, and his foreign girlfriends end up paying for things for him a lot of the time. So even though he's now in his 30s, he still has all the time in the world to hang out, surf, dance, blow bubbles around his room with a plastic wand, and tell me his life story.
En la selva, ha pasado así, cosas así.
Freddie tells me more about life in the Amazon jungle, the magnetic powers of anacondas, a specially fermented drink called chicha de yuca, and how tigers press their paws into human and animal footprints in order to judge the vulnerability of their prey. He also describes a special potion from a fish called bujeo. When you take out its fat and make this into a cream with medicinal plants, Freddie says, it has the power to make another person fall madly in love with you.
Si yo tengo esto, tu mano, tengo mi crema, yo te pongo en tu mano, y en un día, al otro día, tú estás loco por mí.
Did you ever use this potion, I ask? Yes, he says.
Sí.
On you, the first time that I met you.
¿Cuándo te conocí?
Freddie says that in the years I was away, he returned to the jungle once and saw his family. Were they happy to see you, I ask? Freddie's face grows sad and it seems like he might cry. It was a little strange, he says. Sometimes when I arrive at Freddie's apartment, he's lying on his bed listening to a slow, plaintive ballad. He says that he has everything, and yet he has nothing. He points to a wall that's totally covered with postcards from friends and girlfriends from all over the world. They always leave, he says. Tourists come, enjoy his smile, his laugh, his generosity, his dancing, his company, and his fascinating life story. And then move on. People coming and going, but never staying, as if Freddie's world is a theme park, not a home. Seeing Freddie sad, I start to feel guilty, for I know that despite our strong connection and the great influence Freddie has had on me, I'm going to leave him soon just like the others. Welcome to Freddie's theme park, I think, where I, too, am just passing through.
¿Viste la parte que dice, no?
Sí.
Un buen jugador es un buen jugador.
That was independent producer Carla Seidel. She has written about her experiences in her just-released anthropological memoir, The Sophisticated Savage. It's published by Inner Hearth Books. This is Sidetrack. Meet Charlotte, bioengineer by day, avid dumpster diver by night. She shops in dumpsters in an attempt to reduce her environmental footprint. Independent producer Lisa Song followed along to find out more.
So, what did you eat for breakfast?
I had a dumpstered strawberry and banana parfait with some granola and yogurt.
Meet Charlotte, bioengineer by day, avid dumpster diver by night. A few years ago, Charlotte and her boyfriend Dan started picking their food from the trash heaps of local grocery stores.
So the first time my boyfriend and I went dumpster diving, we found a whole lot of local organically grown peppers and tomatoes. In fact, we found probably 5 or 6 garbage bags packed full of them, and the peppers were individually wrapped in pairs and looked absolutely beautiful. The stores were just clearly overstocked.
Supermarkets only keep the freshest items on their shelves, and everything else is thrown away. According to the USDA, American stores toss out more than 5 billion pounds of food a year. That's enough to feed the country's homeless population for 500 days.
It really is a question to me of what would minimize the waste of food. It's not even a question of personal gain or gain for my friends. It's a question of making sure everything gets used one way or another.
Some supermarkets donate day-old bread to homeless shelters, but most stores are afraid to give out other foods in case people blame them for getting sick. On a drizzling night in March, Charlotte and Dan confronted the dumpster behind a Boston-area grocery store. Inside the dumpster were dozens of garbage bags filled with bananas, frozen pizza, and jars of mango salsa. Is that a chocolate cake?
Yeah, right there. Lately, we've always been finding all healthy stuff like fruits and vegetables, and I'm always like, oh, I hope we find a chocolate cake.
Within minutes, they had grabbed enough bags to fill up the back of a rented pickup truck. It's important to work quickly. The police usually ignore dumpster divers, but sometimes they can charge you for trespassing.
If the stakes were really high, I would probably not dumpster dive as much. Being charged for trespass is really not a big legal issue, and for the most part, as long as you're respectful to store owners and respectful to their property, that doesn't become a problem anyway.
After driving home, Charlotte and Dan sorted through their finds.
But this is one of the most fun parts of dumpster diving is you get cans where the label has come off. And then you can take bets on what's inside. So we've got, pre-cut pineapple in a box. I don't know why this is thrown out. Oh, it expires 3/9/09, yesterday.
Food in the United States is labeled with expiration dates, like sell by April 1st or best if used before May 2nd. Professor Catherine Bohr, a food scientist from Cornell University, explains.
For the most part, there's no universal federal regulations for food dating in the United States. Something like best if used by, that is the company's way of telling you that you're more likely to have a product that tastes fresher as opposed to stale.
Eating dry bagels from a dumpster is one thing, but Charlotte is careful to avoid meat and other foods that could give her food poisoning. She also keeps track of recalled products that might be dangerous.
This is the fun part when you get into the like sludge at the bottom of a really mixed bag. Some kind of ratatouille sauce.
After composting the inedible food, Charlotte divided the rest into boxes. Some of it will be shared with the neighbors. By now it's nearly 4 in the morning, and Charlotte will barely have time to sleep before she bikes to work.
I'm a research scientist, and I really feel strongly that my research has a positive impact on the world, but sometimes on a day-to-day basis, think of how much stuff I put out into the environment, how much electricity I use for my equipment, and it makes me kind of depressed. So I guess dumpster diving makes me feel really good about my lifestyle outside of work having neutral or even a positive impact on the world.
The Dumpstering Life was produced by Lisa Song. Thank you to Charlotte, Dan, and Professor Bohr for all of their help.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Albert Cashier was born in Ireland on Christmas Day of 1843, came to America, and fought in the Civil War. After the war, he retired to the small town of Sodom in Illinois. But Cashier was hiding a secret and a legacy that people in that small town still struggle with today. We get the story from independent producer Linda Paul.
In Sonoman, Illinois, an old house is stacked in pieces on a hay wagon inside a barely used storage building. Townspeople remember that house and stories about the eccentric Civil War veteran who once lived there. That veteran was named Albert Cashier, also known as Jenny Hodgers. Over the years, the town has struggled to figure out what to do with that old house and Albert's legacy.
My name is Nina Catherine Cheesbrough. I grew up in Sonoman, Illinois, and my dad was a blacksmith there.
93-year-old Nina Cheesbrough never knew Albert Cashier. He died when she was just a few months old. It was her great-uncle, Joshua, who hired Albert when he first came to town. Nina's father also knew Albert and told stories about him.
The boys in Sonoman in the summertime sometimes went to a farm to go swimming in the creek, and Albert looked after sheep there. And when the boys came out to swim, he sat on the bank, and he never took off his vest. Didn't matter how hot it got, he always wore his vest.
The reason Albert never took off his vest didn't become plain until about 40 years later. He was well into his 60s when he was hit by a car, the first car in town, as a matter of fact, and it was discovered that Albert Cashier was actually Jenny Hodgers.
To me, I've never been able to refer to him as Jenny. He's Albert to me. And actually, I was a little bit upset when they put the Jenny tombstone on, because to me, he was Albert.
The town made a choice to add Jenny's name to Albert's tombstone, and the village board has also decided to rebuild Jenny's old house. Some people in town aren't so sure about that decision. They think it's a little odd to create a monument to a cross-dressing soldier, but not Nina Cheesbrough.
It's just been done at all times. And some people, that's what they want to do. And if they get by with it, they must be satisfied.
Albert D.J. Cashier was the shortest soldier in the 95th Illinois Infantry. In one of the few existing photographs of Cashier during the war, you can faintly detect the outline of breasts under her uniform. But that's if you're looking for it. In the military, apparently, was not.
They didn't conduct physical exams in those days the way the military does now. What they were looking for was warm bodies, people who could stand up straight, who obviously could see and could hear, and hopefully could speak English so they could follow orders. That sufficed in many instances.
Rodney Davis is a retired professor of history at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. He taught American history, including the Civil War, and knew all about the exceptional story of Albert Cashier. And in one of those real-life twists that seems too lucky to be true, years ago, Davis found some letters in an old family trunk that belonged to his great-grandfather, C.W. Ives. To his astonishment, he discovered that his own great-grandfather was the commanding officer to Albert D.J. Cashier.
C.W. Ives was her first sergeant. His first sergeant, however you want to do it, his, her first sergeant. And they were together for at least 2 years, so they got to know each other rather well.
Jenny Hodgers, masquerading as Albert Cashier, marched thousands of miles. She was at the siege of Vicksburg and the surrender of Mobile. Her regiment took part in more than 40 skirmishes and battles.
Albert Cashier seems to have been in from the beginning to the end. She stuck it out.
Almost 50 years after the Civil War ended, U.S. Pension Bureau officials discovered that Albert Cashier was actually a woman. They figured they'd uncovered something like what we today call identity theft, so they launched a fraud investigation. It seemed impossible to believe that a frail little woman drawing a veteran's pension could actually have fought throughout the Civil War. Rodney Davis says his great-grandfather was one of several former comrades who successfully rallied to Jenny's defense. Her status as a Union Army veteran, to them, trumped her identity as a woman.
Their regard for her, I think, was not going to be altered a bit by the fact that it was discovered that she was play-acting. She demonstrated that she was as good as they were, she was as brave as they were, as effective a soldier. They remembered that. And for her to be a woman was obviously worthy of remark, but it's not anything that seems to have made them turn away from her.
After her gender was discovered, Jenny Hodgers told different stories to different people about why she had started her life as a man. For instance, she said she had come to the United States from Ireland as a stowaway and had to dress as a cabin boy on the ship. She told another person that she posed as a man so that she could follow her lover into the war. Rodney Davis says that on a visit to Jenny Hodgers late in her life, his great-grandfather also asked for an explanation.
And according to Ives' interview in the Omaha Bee, cashier replied, "Lots of boys enlisted under the wrong name. So did I. The country needed men, and I wanted excitement. I worked on an Illinois farm as a man the year before the war. I wasn't discovered. I thought I'd try my luck in the service."
In that same interview, C.W. Ives describes Albert Cashier as, quote, "a fearless boy." But during the war, at least one fellow soldier had less flattering remarks.
"These are all original Civil War muskets that were used at the time. That's a Spencer rifle."
That's Frank Crawford, who has a Civil War collection of museum quality at his house.
"This is a Spencer carbine. You can see it's quite a bit shorter."
Crawford's on the board of directors of Illinois' Boone County Historical Society. He has almost 200 letters that a Samuel Pepper wrote home to his wife during the Civil War. For a while, Pepper was a tent mate of Cashier's, and they ran an informal laundering service for other soldiers. Here's Frank Crawford reading from one of Pepper's letters.
"We got along with the washing very well, as he is a good washerwoman."
Later in that letter, Pepper talks of Albert Cashier becoming outraged when Pepper didn't collect all the debts they were owed.
"I put up with all I could bear. Finally," said I, "Albert, did I ever do anything to please you? I said, we cannot live in peace. We had better part at once. I cannot live cat and dog fashion."
But of course, Samuel Pepper had no idea he was sparring with a woman. In his letter, he continues venting to his wife for several more paragraphs. He complains that Cashier, or Chub, as he calls him, uses vulgar language and selfishly squeezes to the middle spot of the tent on cold nights.
"Chub would squeeze in between me and Lyman, never taking his turn on the outside. He and Lyman were soon at sword's point with each other, but a word by me would soon drop the angry talk."
Finally, Pepper tells his wife that Albert Cashier is a cant. That's an old term for someone who pretends to be pious, but really isn't.
"He is generous to a fault when all is well, but when anything crosses his path, he is a stinging little devil in human shape."
To get an idea why Jenny Hodgers may have subjected herself to the rigors of war, you need to know a little about the U.S. job market in 1861.
Well, a private in the Union Army made $13 a month, which was easily double what a woman would make as a laundress or a seamstress or even a maid.
Deanne is co-author of They Fought Like Demons, Women Soldiers in the Civil War. She's a senior military archivist at the National Archives and has documented hundreds of women who masqueraded as men during the war. She says many economic reasons and economic reasons.
But they in the pants and earning more money and spending their money, they seemed to greatly enjoy the freedom that came with being perceived as a man.
Women at the time of the Civil War couldn't vote. If they were married, they couldn't own property in their own name. They mostly depended on men to survive. In return, they were supposed to devote their time and talents entirely to husbands, children, and their extended families. That was the Victorian ideal. An ideal, Blanton says, that was mostly aimed at middle and upper class women. And they're not the ones who went off to war.
The women who went to war, who disguised themselves as men and carried a gun, were overwhelmingly working class women, immigrant women, poor women, urban women, and yeoman farm girls.
Jenny Hodgers was part of this group. She was an immigrant from Cloggerhead, Ireland, who couldn't read or write. By the end of the war, she needed to make some tough decisions about her identity. If she stayed Albert Cashier, it was more likely she'd find work, keep the friends she made during the war, and be part of a respected community of Civil War veterans.
She can have a bank account. She can vote in elections, and she did, by the way. Or if she goes back and puts on a dress and tells everyone that she's Jenny, she has just lost her entire life.
Jenny's decision? To continue her life as a man. A few years after the war, posing as Albert Cashier, she made her way to Sonneman, Illinois. She worked many jobs, including a stint as a farmhand and the town lamplighter. She ended up living in the little house that today sits in a desolate storage building.
Okay.
Sonneman is a pretty sleepy place. Just a grain elevator, a few other businesses, and the tap, the only restaurant and bar along the main strip of town.
You got spaghetti tonight?
No, only on Tuesdays.
Some townspeople think that rebuilding the old Cashier house could give a tourism boost to this little town. Others are skeptical, says lifelong resident William Baker.
It's the site of an old building. I mean, it's not too pretty. I've seen it. I know what it is. And I think that's one of the things that people are a little bit disturbed about.
Baker mows the lawn at the cemetery in town. He's amazed at the number of people who show up looking for Albert's grave.
I mean, you never know who's going to drive in and ask about it. I mean, it's not a big deal to us, but somebody from away come here to see where Albert Cashier is buried.
Jim Schultz lives on a farm outside of Sonneman. He and his wife Dinah have heard talk around town.
Some people, I think, are looking toward this, that it's going to bring us a certain amount of tourism. And other people, I think, frankly, would rather everybody not know we had a cross-dresser in Sonneman.
I wouldn't like to think that's what puts us on the map, but maybe it is.
The town was not especially proud of Albert. They thought it was kind of a funny story. They thought she was just a weird woman. And they really were, some of them were a bit ashamed of the whole thing.
Cheryl O'Donnell is a church secretary and Albert Cashier proponent. Since the 1960s, a lot of locals have been trying to save the Cashier house, got involved about 20 years ago. One time, they were so desperate, they agreed to give the house to a war reenactment group in a neighboring county. But the house was 3 inches too high to make it down the highway.
So we literally the roof off. It had to be replaced anyway. But at least it would get it there. Then they backed out.
Over the years, the house has been leased to 8 or 9 spots. For a while, it was next to the Sonneman fire station.
And town was heads up with it. They thought it was an eyesore. They said either fix it up now or get it out of town. We don't want it. We're going to burn it for a practice drill fire station. They thought that was funny when they told us that, you know.
Just as the house was about to go up in smoke, it was saved by Betty Estes, the tourism director of Pontiac, the town just down the road. Estes convinced her mayor to move the house to a city storage area. For some years, it sat under a blue tarp in the weeds next to Santa Claus's house, which the town of Pontiac hauls out each year at Christmas. But in the meantime, the town of Pontiac was bringing loads of people over to Sonneman to view Albert Cashier's grave. And it seems the city board of Sonneman took notice, because about a year ago, the house was moved again.
I've never been in.
Probably in for a surprise.
Cheryl O'Donnell is walking into the large, dark warehouse house where Albert Cashier's house sits. The village board has some big plans to finally reconstruct the old house and put it close to the spot where Albert used to live.
Oh my goodness, it really is in parts. But it's doable. It's still doable.
It's Memorial Day, and Cheryl O'Donnell has brought me to the cemetery where Jenny Hodgers is buried. Because Jenny works hard to guard her spirit, Donald sometimes feels a little guilt.
I'm wondering if she's somewhere chastising me for bringing her in spotlight.
Squad, and hut. We'll now read the roster. Spanish in America, William DeVoe.
Many in town have gathered for a read of the names. Veterans from Sonneman who have served in America's wars.
Silver, E. Brown, John H. Byrne, Albert D.J. Cashier.
It's not any Hodger's name that's read on Memorial Day, because it's Town Albert, the town remembers. And it wasn't Jen when the Dina sent insane asylum at the end of her life on the Albert's name commitment papers. Here's what happened. Late in her life, Jenny Hodgers was still living undetected as Albert Cashier Sonneman. But at age 67, when she was hit live at a soldier, she was sent to live at a soldiers and sailors home for disabled war vet people. A couple of people there knew her secret, but remarkably, it was before 2 years before it made it into newspapers around the Pension Bureau. That's when the pension fraud launched its fraud investigation. About the same time, I'm confused, noisy. Bolivian was called today. As was typical, she was typical. Deemed and dispatched to an asylum. Our public sanity occurred. No mention is made of Albert Cashier being a woman. The evidence is strictly related to senility. It's impossible to reposing know if Jenny posing a tan. The mate's decision to declare her sane. Is that soon she got, no, once she got the asylum, the identity she identified was as they may have scored, corrected. She was placed in the women's ward and to wear skirts.
Carol was so irritating to her that she would take pins and pin the skirt together between the legs to make them look like pants. And when she did that, they were very awkward because they were so baggy and she fell. And the fall resulted in a infection, and she never ever recovered from the infection. That was the cause of the death.
Though for a season they must be people of war, let them live for peace.
In the end, Jenny Hodgers did get rid of that dreaded, cumbersome skirt. Albert Cashier's comrades made sure that she was buried in her soldier's uniform, and that she received a proper military funeral. If things go according to plan, in the next year or so, Jenny's secret will be exposed to a larger audience. Visitors will be able to come to her gravesite and to Jenny's old house to hear all about her remarkable and complicated life.
That story was produced by Linda Paul with help from Jay Allison and the public radio website transom.org, with support from the Open Studio Project, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.